From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Horror of the Pool. As I've already remarked, there are many traditions and stories of ghostly happenings associated with my branch of the old O'Donnells and my grandmother's family, the Vises of Cork and Limerick. There are also many stories of the supernatural associated with my O'Brien and Monsell forebears. My father, who collected many of these stories and was deeply interested in ghost lore, contacted the supernatural himself on more than one occasion. The adventure I'm about to relate occurred while my father was an undergraduate at TCD. He arranged one long vacation to go on a walking tour in the west of Ireland with his friend Bob Hunt of Limerick. As Hunt was unexpectedly detained, my father set off alone. He came one day after a long tramp through a wild and barren country to a wayside pool. My father did not excel in games, but he was a good swimmer. Feeling very hot and sticky, for the day was very close, he decided to bathe. The road was lonely and little frequented. There were no motorists in those days. He took off his clothes and plunged into the pool. He was surprised to find that despite the heat, the water was extremely cold. The blazing sun rays did not appear to affect the temperature. A few rapid strokes took him to the far side of the pool. He was preparing to turn about when he fancied he was no longer alone in the pool, that some horrible thing was getting ready to seize him. He scrambled out of the water in a panic. Seeing nothing to account for his alarm, he laughed and blamed himself for being so easily frightened. He leaped into the pool again and was about halfway across it when he experienced the same sensation, only an even more terrifying degree. He struck out wildly for the shore, expecting every moment to feel clammy arms or tentacles clutch hold of him. He put on his clothes without drying himself properly and did not feel safe until he was out of sight of the pool. He did not see it again for several years. In the meanwhile, much had happened in his life. He had graduated at TCD and, at the earnest desire of his mother, had resigned the commission in the army and taken holy orders. He was visiting his mother in Limerick when he felt an urge to see once again the pool of horror by the lonely roadside. He went there accompanied by one of his Limerick friends. They were gazing at the still dark waters when they were joined by a stranger who told him that he owned a house within a short distance of the pool. My father had not noticed the house until the stranger pointed it out to him. "It is surely new," my father exclaimed. "I can't remember seeing it when I was here a few years ago." "It was built exactly 3 years ago," the stranger said. "I bought it, and now I am anxious to sell it. This pool seems to interest you. You are not thinking of bathing in it, are you?" My father shook his head. "No, once was quite enough." He told the stranger what had happened when he was last there. "It was just my imagination, of course," he said. "I don't think so," the stranger remarked. "Do you believe in the supernatural?" "You should do, as you are a clergyman." "At least, I take you for one in those clothes." "I am a clergyman, and I do believe in the supernatural," my father said. "Are you trying to tell me that this pool is haunted?" "Can you spare a few minutes?" the stranger asked. "What I have to say won't take very long." My father and his friends said they would be very interested to listen to anything that he had to tell them about the pool. "I'm a widower," the stranger began. "My two nieces live with me, and I have an old woman who cooks and does various other things. I was the first occupant of the house yonder, and while I lived in it, hardly a night passed without something very disturbing happening. We all had terrifying dreams, and were awakened by queer noises, creakings, the rattling of door handles, the soft padding footsteps on the stairs, and even in our rooms. One night, my youngest niece felt her bed rise up and down, as if there was someone under it trying to frighten her. I heard her scream and ran to her room at once. I found her unconscious. She had fainted and was quite alone in the room. A few nights later, I had a similar experience. I sprang out of bed, lit a candle, and searched the house. There was no one in it but our four selves. The doors, front and back, were locked and bolted. The windows on the ground floor were latched and shuttered. No one from outside had entered. There was only one satisfactory explanation, namely, the supernatural. Weeks passed, and then, one night, the cook screamed. I ran to her room and found her terrified. She declared that something spongy and clammy had crawled onto the bed and tried to smother her. I had the greatest difficulty in pacifying her. She expressed the odd belief that the thing that was haunting the house and frightening us so much came from the pool. She is a native of Kerry, and like so many of the Munster people, is a firm believer in focus, leprechauns, and spirits of all kinds. Neither I nor my nieces had ever liked this pool. We felt that there was something very unpleasant about it, and fond as we were of swimming, we had never cared to bathe in it. I hope I am not boring you. My father and his friend told him that they were very interested and wanted him to continue. Well, one night, he said, I kept watch outside the house, and at about 1:30, I saw a shadowy figure approach the house from the direction of the pool. It gave me the impression of something pulpy and loathsome, without any definite shape. I moved hastily out of the way and sighed into the house. A few minutes later, I heard screams and found one of my nieces half mad with terror. She said she heard the bedroom door open and something cold and slimy touched her cheek and forehead. That settled me. Convinced that the house was haunted by something evil and harmful, I shut it up and rented a cottage about 1.5 miles from here. I go to the house once or twice a week to air it, but never at night. Have you any idea why this pool should be haunted? My father asked. No, he replied. I've been told that pools and lakes in lonely localities sometimes attracts a species of spirits that is particularly terrifying and dangerous. More I cannot say. The whys and wherefores of the supernatural are quite beyond our ken, and will probably ever remain so. Some North Country Hauntings. Lancashire abounds in traditionary stories and legends, many of which are about Bogarts. A house near Rochdale was for many years haunted by a Bogart that used to terrify people by crawling into their rooms during the night, putting a clammy hand on their faces and stripping the bedclothes off them. The house, in consequence of its molestations, was often vacated. Clayton Hall is said to have been once haunted by a Bogart that was also in the habit of depriving people of their bedclothes, which it hid in places where they were least likely to find them. It was finally laid by a priest. A Bogart that haunted a farm near Blackburn used to scare the farmer's wife by snatching her baby from under her nose. It carried a screaming brat to the kitchen and deposited none too gently on the hearthstone, to the surprise and indignation of the cook. A cottage not very far from the farm was haunted by a Bogart that frightened the sole occupant, an old woman, by shaking her, pulling her ears, thumping on a chest, and gnashing its hideous long yellow teeth. The Troller's Gill, a wild lonely ravine that intersects the bleak moorlands forming the watershed between the waters of the tributaries of the Wharfe and Nidd, is haunted by a Bargest in the form of a huge dog with shaggy hair and glaring eyes. A weird light surrounds it. Its advent is generally regarded as a portent of extreme misfortune to whoever sees it. A farm servant was threading his way through the gill late one evening when the Bargest emerged from behind a large boulder. The servant muttered a prayer and crossed himself. The Bargest howled and vanished. The servant, who was terrified, hurried to his destination, and when he arrived there found his wife seriously ill. The following day his mother died suddenly, and his only child met with a bad accident. An account of a Bargest that haunted the vicinity of Ralston in Midderdale was published in the supplement of the Leeds Mercury in February 1881. A man named Billy was returning home late one night from Grassington when he heard the clanking of a chain, a sure sign of the near proximity of a Bargest. He glanced apprehensively around him and saw a Bargest a little distance ahead of him. It was dragging the chain, which was attached to the collar round its neck, over the rugged ground as it moved. It was going in the direction of his home, and he followed it. It disappeared suddenly. When he reached his house, it was sitting in front of the garden gate. It bared its long, pointed teeth and glared savagely at him. It was preparing to rush at him when his wife came out of the house and threw a horseshoe at it. The horseshoe passed right through it. The barges sank into the ground and disappeared. Horseshoes are deemed to be a protection against barges and bogarts, and that is one reason why in certain parts of the north of England they are so often hung on gates and doors. Homicidal ghosts. One of the strangest cases of spirits doing actual physical harm is recorded in a pamphlet published in 1662. Mr. John Luck, a farmer of Raveley, set out on horseback one morning to the annual fair at Whittlesey. On the way he met a friend with whom he had a drink at a wayside inn. After drinking somewhat heavily, Mr. Luck became very merry, and perceiving that his friend was getting restless and desirous of continuing on his way to the fair, he said, "Let the devil take him who goeth out of this house today." The more he drank, the merrier he grew. Forgetful of his rash saying, he called for his horse and set out for the fair. The fresh air seemed to have a sobering effect, for he had not traveled very far before he remembered what he had said. He was naturally superstitious and became so perturbed that he lost his bearings. He was endeavoring to find the way home. It was getting dusk and far too late to go to the fair, when he spied two grim creatures before him in the likeness of griffins. They handled him roughly, took him up in the air, stripped him, and then dropped him. A sad spectacle, all gory, in a farmyard just outside the town of Doddington. There he was found lying upon some harrows. He was picked up and carried to a house which belonged to a neighboring gentleman. When he had recovered sufficiently to talk, he related what had happened to him. Before very long, he grew into a frenzy so desperate that the inmates of the house were afraid to stay in the room with him. Convinced that Luck was under evil influence, they sent for the clergyman of the town. No sooner had the clergyman entered the house than Luck, howling like a demon, rushed at him and would have torn him to pieces had not the servants of the house come to the rescue. They succeeded with great difficulty in overcoming Luck and tying him to the bed. No one was allowed to enter his room, the door of which was locked. The next morning he was found lying on the bed with his neck broken, his tongue out of his mouth, his body black as a shoe, all swelled, every bone out of joint, and an expression of the greatest horror in his eyes. Those who viewed his dead body and knew what he had said at the inn about the devil expressed their conviction that he had met his death at the hands of Satan's fiends. A very unpleasant case of haunting. Also by something very evil was reported in the Weekly Budget. A young man residing at a boarding house in a town in the United States of America began suddenly to grow very pale and thin. He awoke every morning to find a curious puncture on one of his arms, from which blood had apparently been drawn. Considerably puzzled as to the cause of the puncture, he lay awake one night, and when he felt something cold press against one of his arms and bite him, he lit a candle at once. Although he searched everywhere in the room, he could not find anything to account for the bite. Blood was oozing from the wound. The following night, the same thing happened. This time he sensed a presence in the room, but when he lit the candle, he saw nothing. He felt such a horror of the room that he left the house and moved elsewhere. Other people who occupied the room after he left had similar experiences. The house, in consequence, obtained an evil reputation. People who lived in the town believed that it was haunted by a vampire, that is to say, by the accursed body of some former dweller in the house who could not find rest in the neighboring cemetery, but nightly left the grave to suck the blood of anyone who slept in the room which it had occupied when alive. When I was ranching in the far west of the United States, I stayed one night in the cabin of a man named Trench, who lived in the heart of a vast forest in the region of the Cascade Mountains. He lived quite alone. There was no human habitation near him. He told me that he often heard strange, unaccountable noises, and that one night, when he could not sleep, he saw a tall, luminous green figure standing in the doorway of the cabin. It was quite nude, with long arms and legs, and a long, white face, with no nose, mouth, or ears, only long, glittering, evil eyes. Trench tried to reach his gun, which was on the floor near the bed, but he was temporarily paralyzed, and in that state unable to move a limb or utter a sound. He watched the figure into the cabin and bend over his dog, which was lying in a corner of the room. The dog gave a yelp of pain and terror. The sound it made freed Trench from the spell which bound him. He got hold of his gun and fired at the figure. The bullet seemed to pass right through it. The figure vanished. When Trench looked at his dog, it was lying crumpled up with its neck broken. I told Trench about an experience that I had one night in the forest. I was returning home on horseback from Crater Lake, at the time seldom visited except by Indians from the neighboring reservation territory. Every now and then I heard coyotes in the distance. There is a mistaking the canine bark that ends in an unmistakable lupine howl. I had to dismount once in order to kill a rattlesnake that seemed inclined to dispute the right of way with me. Soon after this little diversion, I came to a clearing in the forest, through which the track wound a sinuous course. Some little distance ahead of me was a solitary tree on a bare piece of ground that skirted the track. There was something very sinister in the appearance of the tree. It was quite naked and looked as if it had been blasted. "And your horse would not go near it?" Trench exclaimed. "You are quite right," I said. It stood stock still and trembled, as if it had had the ague. "I know the tree," Trench observed. "No animal will go near it. It is called the Tree of Death, because so many people have been found dead under it. The Indians say it is haunted by a spirit with the trunk of a woman and the head of a coyote that lures people to the tree and either induces them to commit suicide or murders them." He asked if I had ever heard of a phantom tree. I said that I had heard of phantom trees in Europe, Asia, and Africa, but not in America. He told me that there was one in the forest, that the Rogue River Indians called it the Devil Tree, and that whoever saw it always met with grave misfortune afterwards. I told him that I hoped I should never see the Devil Tree, as I considered that I had more than my share of misfortune. Very unusual hauntings. Herb von Bosco, in his autobiography, states how he was haunted for some considerable time by a very aggressive ghost. He was engaged one evening, soon after the Battle of Jena, in translating a pamphlet into Polish, when he felt a vigorous poke in his loins. He looked round and saw a boy of about 12 years of age. There was no one else in the room, the door of which was shut. Had anyone entered, he must have heard him. Realizing that the intruder was a phantom, he struck at it, but with no apparent effect. The apparition attacked him again and gave his left arm a particularly painful twist. He finally succeeded in driving it away. It continued to visit him constantly during 4 months, and on each occasion assaulted him, striking and punching him. By degrees its visits became more and more rare, until it finally appeared not in the form of a boy, but in that of a tall brown figure with the head of an owl. The strange expression of a youth named Billing is recorded in the same book. The well-known German writer, Herr Pfeffel, lived in a house near Colmar. In the rear of the house was a very lovely old-world garden that had a peculiar attraction for young Billing, who constantly visited Herr Pfeffel. When the weather was fine, they strolled around the garden, and on each of these occasions, Herr Pfeffel, who was blind, took the arm of Billing. Pfeffel noticed one evening that on passing over a certain spot, Billing started violently, as if he had received an electric shock. He asked Billing the reason, and Billing said there was no reason, that he was not aware he had started. On going over the same spot again, the same thing occurred. Billing, being pressed to explain the cause of his apparent alarm, declared that it arose from a horrible sensation which he always experienced when in the vicinity of human remains, that it was his impression that a human body was buried in that particular spot. He asked Pfeffel to visit the spot with him during the night and said that he thought it highly probable that he would then be able to tell if his surmise was correct. Accordingly, they went together to the garden about midnight. As they approached the spot, Billing observed a faint light over it. At about 10 paces from it, he halted and would not proceed any further. He declared that he saw, hovering over the spot, a luminous female figure nearly 5 feet high in height, with her right arm folded over her breast, her left arm hanging by her side. Pfeffel stepped forward and placed himself on the haunted spot. The figure at once began to move about. It appeared first on the right side of Pfeffel, then on his left side, now behind him, now in front of him. When Pfeffel struck at it, his stick went right through it. They visited the spot the next night with some of Pfeffel's friend. The same thing occurred. Unknown to Billing, Pfeffel had the ground dug up. At a depth of several feet beneath a layer of quicklime, the remains of a woman in an advanced stage of decomposition were found. They were removed and the earth carefully replaced. 3 days later, Billing, who was suffering from severe shock, and had not been told about the findings of the remains, was induced, not without difficulty, to visit the spot again, accompanied as hitherto by Pfeffel. This time he walked over it without starting or receiving any horrible impression. The haunting had ceased. No suspicion regarding the remains seemed to have been attached to Pfeffel, presumably because he had not occupied the house for more than a few months, but his conduct seems to have been somewhat extraordinary. Fearsome Heads. I am concluding this volume with hauntings by phantom heads, which are very often terrifying and sometimes diabolical. In the Christmas number of the Review of Reviews, published in the early 90s of the last century, there is an interesting account of a phantom head. A lady was searching for something on the landing of her house at Brockley one Saturday evening, when she raised her eyes and saw, to her astonishment, a peculiar light on the staircase above her. It developed very quickly into a head, crowned with thick, matted, light hair. It was surrounded with a gruesome greenish-yellow light. The face was wide and broad, with green eyes, the expression of which was diabolically malignant. The lady felt that such an awful thing could only be satanic. Endeavoring to be calm, she fixed her gaze on it and said, "In the name of Christ, be gone," whereupon the apparition at once vanished. She never saw it again. She could not imagine why such a horrible apparition should visit her home. The house was a very ordinary London suburban villa. It was not old, and no tragedy was known to have occurred in it. The previous occupants of the house had been seemingly quiet, very ordinary people. Apparently the head was not the portent of any very serious happening, but its intentions was doubtless harmful, and had it been able to remain in the house, it might have fulfilled its evil design. An old country house in Hertfordshire was haunted by two satanic phantom heads until a Roman Catholic priest successfully exorcised them. Phantom heads not infrequently haunt certain families and seem to take a fiendish delight in warning them of some approaching calamity. An Italian lady, whom I met in New York in 1934, told me that her family was haunted by a malignant phantom head that always appeared before the death of one of her relatives. She said her brother saw it the night her mother died, and that she and her twin sister saw it before the death of her father. She and her sister slept in the same room. They were awakened simultaneously one night by curious noise in the cupboard facing their beds. They sat up, and one of them was about to get out of bed to see if their cat was in the room, when the cupboard door suddenly opened and a luminous head appeared. It was covered with matted black hair and looked in an advanced stage of decomposition. Its pale, bleak eyes gleamed exultingly as they met the gaze of the terrified sisters, and its hideous, fleshless mouth grinned, revealing jagged, badly decayed teeth. Directly the sisters murmured prayers and crossed themselves, the head vanished. The following day they learned that their father, who was away from home, had died suddenly at about the time that they had seen the head. Clotilde, the little daughter of the unfortunate queen of Etruria or Tuscany, who was dispossessed of her kingdom by the first Napoleon and held in captivity at Nice, was for a brief time haunted by a phantom head. Her mother, fearful of what Napoleon might be planning to do to her and her children, dispatched two faithful members of her suite to Holland for the purpose of arranging preliminaries for her and her family's secret flight to England. On the night of the 15th of April, 1811, the ex-queen was lying awake in her large, gloomy bedroom at Nice, when she saw the door slowly open, and Cimpanti, the most trusted of her two absent agents, entered the apartment. He halted within a pace or two of the bed, and the queen noticed that he was pale as death. For a full minute, the dead and the living gazed upon each other. Then, as the queen forced her lips to pronounce his name, the apparition vanished. She knew then that her faithful servant was no more. Clotilde slept in a little room adjoining her apartment. At breakfast the next morning, Clotilde appeared ill and out of spirits. With difficulty, her mother prevailed upon her to explain the cause, when, with a burst of tears, she declared that Cimpanti had kept her awake the whole night by perpetually thrusting his head into the room, and that from his strange, wild look and white face, she was certain that he must be seriously ill or mad. She was very terrified. The queen soon afterwards learned that Cimpanti had been arrested while on his way to Holland and executed about the time she had seen his apparition. Robert Hunt, in Popular Romances of the West of England, relates a haunting by Half a Face. A man named Berryman rented a house in the neighborhood of Lalant. His son James said that when he was in bed at night, he often saw half a man's face, enveloped in a gruesome light, enter the room, stop for a few moments at the foot of his bed, and then vanish. He was always terrified. Immediately before it appeared, the cat, which slept in the room, always jumped onto the bed and tried to hide itself under his clothes. James said his father never admitted that he saw the apparition, but seemed very glad when he relinquished his tenancy of the house. Phantom heads lacking features seemed to be fairly common. The phantom of a woman with no eyes haunted Barton Hall in Somerset and terrified two sisters who saw it. The famous brown lady phantom of Rainham also lacked eyes. One of the ghosts that haunted a house near the Roman Catholic Cathedral in Birmingham had no features. Its face was a complete blank. Leap Castle in Ireland was for many years reputed to be badly haunted. One of the ghosts resembled a little old man in green clothes. The other ghost, which was also small, had a featureless face and was covered with something resembling wool. It haunted a gallery in the castle and terrified people by creeping noiselessly up to them and suddenly putting clammy hands that had no fingers on their shoulders. One lady was very ill for months after she saw it. The haunting, which ceased more than 50 years ago, was said to be due to certain dark deeds perpetrated in the castle by an ancient Irish chieftain, who, for his many evil deeds, was doomed to haunt the castle for 7 centuries. One of the most ghastly accounts of a complex haunt, in which one of the phenomena was a terrible head, was published in the San Francisco Examiner in 1891. A farmer named Walsingham rented a house in Oakville. Shortly after he had moved into it, the whole household was disturbed at night by the banging of doors, ringing of bells, and howling of the farmer's dog, a big, intelligent mastiff. Mr. Walsingham went downstairs to see what was happening and found the dog in the hall whining and barking. It leaped furiously at some invisible presence and fell back, as if flung by powerful hands. It lay huddled upon the ground, and when Mr. Walsingham examined it, he found its neck had been broken. The noises occurred night after night, and in addition to those mentioned, there were shouts, groans, piteous cries, and hideous laughter. One evening, Miss Alice Walsingham was arranging her hair in front of the dressing table mirror when she felt a hand grip her shoulder. Thinking that it was her father, she turned quickly round. No one was there, but when she looked at the mirror, she saw in it the reflection of a great ugly hand on her arm. She screamed, and the hand vanished. Mr. Walsingham was in the garden one day and saw footprints of some invisible being formed beside his own on the soft soil. One night, while a family was having supper, blood dripped from the ceiling onto the table, and they all heard the most diabolical noises in the room immediately above them. When they went to the room, the noises ceased at once, and there was nothing visible to account for them. The Walsinghams left the house the next day. After they left, people passing by the house after nightfall heard shouting, yelling, and groaning, and saw gruesome lights in the windows. A man named Horace Gunn of Savannah spent a night in the house and was found in the morning by his friends, lying on the floor in a swoon. He was taken home by them and was ill for days. He said that when he entered the house and tried to light a lamp in one of the rooms, the icy breath of some unseen person blew it out, and he had to remain in the dark. After he had been there for some time, he heard shouts of rage, yells of pain, and feet racing up the stairs and all over the house, as if one person was chasing another. When the chase ended, there were screams of agony, as much groaning and moaning, succeeded by peals of fiendish laughter. After these sounds ceased, there was a long silence. He was thinking that the haunting was over for the night when he saw a spherical, eerie light in the room. It developed very gradually into a head with long gray matted hair. There were bloodstains on the forehead. The eyes, which were wide open, gleamed with an unearthly evil light as they gazed at Mr. Gunn, who was too appalled to move or utter a sound. The head floated in the air about 5 feet, 6 inches above the floor. There was no sign of any body. Directly the noises recommenced with greater violence than before, the head vanished. Mr. Gunn made for the front door at once and had nearly reached it when he was thrown down. Icy hands gripped his throat and he lost consciousness. He was in that state when his friends came to the house. The marks of bony fingers with long nails were visible on his throat for several days after his harrowing experience. The house had by this time acquired such an evil reputation that no one would occupy it, and it was ultimately demolished. Many human bones were found under it and in its grounds. How they came there was never known, but it was supposed that they had lain there for many years, and were the bones of people who might have been murdered when the house was a roadside inn of very bad repute. The Death's Head of Mary King's Close. George Sinclair, professor of moral philosophy in the University of Glasgow, and afterwards minister of Eastwood in Renfrewshire, relates ghostly happenings of the most horrible kind in his book, Satan's Invisible World Discovered. Some of the phenomena were in the house of Mr. Coldheart, a law agent in Mary King's Close, Edinburgh. Mr. Coldheart, finding that the house he was occupying in Edinburgh was rather too small for his family, and rapidly increasing business moved to a much larger, more imposing residence in Mary King's Close. He was warned that the house was haunted, but not believing ghosts, he ridiculed the idea. His maidservant, upon hearing what was rumored about the house, would not stay in it. Consequently, Mr. and Mrs. Coldheart were obliged to manage as best they could without her. One Sunday afternoon, Mrs. Coldheart was seated in her rooms reading the Bible when something, making her look up from the book, she saw, suspended in the air immediately above her, the head of an old man with a long gray beard. The head was surrounded with a gruesome light, and the eyes gleamed so horribly that she fainted. That night Mr. Coldheart awoke and saw the same head floating in midair. It glared at him with its horrible, leering eyes. He knelt down and prayed. Presently the head was joined by the head of a child, and then by an arm, the extended, long, curled fingers of which seemed to want to grip hold of him. Mr. Coldheart and his wife spoke to the apparitions and asked them why they haunted the house. There was no response. After a few minutes, the ghost of a dog appeared in the room and curled itself up on a chair. More ghosts came, and some of them were so monstrous and evil that the Coldhearts hid under the bedclothes. Suddenly, there was a loud, awful groan, and all the ghosts vanished. After such a terrifying experience, one would suppose that the Coldhearts would have got out of the house with the utmost speed. But such was not the case. The brave couple continued to live in the house for many years and were never again troubled by the ghosts. About the time of Mr. Coldheart's death, a strange thing occurred. A client of his who lived at Tranent, about 10 miles from Edinburgh, was aroused during the night by a nurse who told him that there was something like a cloud moving about in the room. He got up at once, seized a sword, and saw the face and form of Thomas Coldheart confronting him. "Are you dead?" he asked. "What is your errand?" The apparition shook its head, solemnly, and faded away very gradually. Mr. Coldheart's client proceeded at once to the law agent's office, and on arriving there learned that Mr. Coldheart was dead. A Phantom Skull Haunting. There are many stories of weird happenings in connections with skulls. One of them is about an old farmstead near Bridport in Dorsetshire that for many years contained the skull of a man who was supposed to have been the negro servant of a Roman Catholic priest. A murder is alleged to have taken place in or near the farmstead. Either the priest murdered the man in order to conceal some crime known to him, or the manservant, for some unknown reason, murdered the priest. Just before he died, the negro declared that his spirit would never rest unless his body was taken to his native land and buried there. As this could not be done, he was buried in the churchyard of Bettiscombe. The night after the funeral and for many succeeding nights, terrible screams were heard by people living in close proximity to the churchyard. In the farmhouse, doors and windows rattled, stairs and boards and bedrooms creaked dismally, and uncanny sounds were heard all over the building. There was no cessation of the disturbances until the body was removed from the churchyard and brought back to the farmhouse. Every time it was reinterred, the nocturnal disturbances were renewed, and this went on until nothing remained of the body except the skull, and every time the skull was removed from the house, the same thing happened. So it was finally decided to provide a permanent resting place for the skull in the farmhouse. This was done, and so far as is known, there was never any further reoccurrence of the ghostly disturbances.